If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
The one thing that I did very, very well was work on my personal brand and really invest time in social media.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
10 years ago, following a career in investment management, Nicole Bremner was at home raising three children under three and unsure what her future held. Fast forward to 2020, and she has a boutique property development company currently building out 105 homes and commercial units across 9 sites in London. Building on her experience and expertise, particularly around the importance of personal branding within the property space, she's often invited to speak at events throughout the world with engagements in Dubai and Canada. She's also a regular property columnist with Modern Woman magazine and a best-selling author of Bricking It.
Hey, Nicole, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, this is a pleasure. My pleasure to have you on. It's good to have someone outside of the United States who is actively investing in real estate. And I think you've done pretty much all of it when it comes to especially, you know, developing and growing a commercial real estate business. So can you kind of give us just a brief overview where you started, where you are now, and how you got there?
Certainly. Well, I'm Australian, actually, and I moved over to the UK. I didn't really know what to do with my life. I wanted to be a banker. I thought it was so glamorous. Everyone of my era watched Wall Street and thought, yeah, I'm going to be a banker. So moved over here and realized it was just incredibly hard. And I probably wasn't that great at it. But I persisted anyway and had a mediocre career in banking. And then moved to the US actually and lived in New York. I started at Goldman Sachs on Wall Street, which was my dream, on the day that Lehman Brothers collapsed back in 2008. So that was my very first day, sitting there just with all the news channels up on the monitors just going, oh my goodness, I don't think my contract's going to be renewed. And it wasn't. So I had an 8-month-old baby, and I found out I was pregnant with the second one. We moved back to London. And it was at that point in time that I started looking at my career and thinking, right, I think the signs are out there that banking just isn't for me and I need to explore some other things. So I did everything. I tried everything. I tried blogging and knitting, teaching people how to knit. I tried photography, just everything. And I'd renovated a flat in central London before we'd moved to New York. And this flat had done incredibly well. And then we bought a house and renovated that, and it did really well. And my partner said to me, listen, you've done incredibly well with these properties. Why don't you consider doing property full time? And that's where it started. And that was in 2009. So that's pretty much in a nutshell how my property journey started.
That's fascinating. So then let's fast forward to 2020. What's your business look like today?
Well, it's very different because right in the beginning, it was a matter of flipping or buying, developing and selling. At the time, I didn't need income. All I wanted to do was just create these beautiful homes, usually luxury homes that I would want to live in. Sure. I created those in areas which were up and coming, very much gentrifying areas. And then I sold those on and made quite a profit. And at the time, and I think it was quite similar in the US as well, is that you're coming out of this world financial crisis. And so everything, the whole economy was just moving up. So my best years were 2012, 13, 14, 15. And everything I touched turned to gold. It was just so easy. And I think that it gives you this almost false sense of reality, actually, because you think, wow, I'm really good at this. But actually, right. I just got very, very lucky. So fast forward to now, I definitely, in hindsight, took on too many projects at once. And that caused some instability within the portfolio. I'm very open about. And so what the last 2 years has been is about just consolidating what I've got, taking stock and reassessing the strategy. So now the strategy is retaining a lot of the portfolio, selling down some in order to pay down debt, de-risking, and then just looking at what's left. and just taking things a bit slower, I think, going forward. So at the moment, what that actually looks like is we've got around just under 100 units now across about 9 different sites. And they're a mixture of residential and commercial. Our largest development's 49 residential flats just on the outskirts of London. And then we've got a single unit that we're just selling at the moment. So it's all quite a range of different projects.
Right. And so you guys are at the point now where like you said, you're taking risk off the table, deleveraging, and really just taking stock of where you are and then kind of circling the wagons and seeing where you want to go from this point moving forward.
Exactly. And I think also is that during my meteoric rise, I picked up a lot of investors along the way, which was great because that helped. And as anyone who's worked with investors knows, when you've got access to additional equity and additional debt, you're able to scale your business much faster. But it comes with a cost. And that cost is that you've got investor relations and you need to keep your investors informed, updated, and happy. And that's really hard. I had 169 investors at one point, just because of the crowdfunding. We were at the forefront of the crowdfunding industry here in the UK. And I think to date, we still hold the record of the most raised in a property crowdfund. So it's really, really hard work. So for me now, it's about exiting as many of the investors as possible and just working, hopefully just on my own, is how, or with my partner. And just having a scaled back portfolio that's much more cash generative and just having an in-house manager to manage those on a day-to-day basis, but being a lot more passive.
Right. So it sounds like for you, you have made obviously money along the way. You've experienced the pains of growth, which we, I'm thinking back on a business we took and we 4X'd revenue in 1 year. And it was probably the hardest year of my life because you go, oh my gosh, like we are just working nonstop. So you guys went through the pains of growth, but then you've taken stock of where you are and said, hey, look, we actually want to kind of change the way we're doing things. I mean, as you scale down in a sense, what's one of the things you're looking like? What do you hope to achieve by actually scaling kind of things down? Like what's the end goal with that?
It's definitely about buying time. So I've always been someone who works really, really intensively. And when my children were younger, it would be about working maybe for 4 weeks really intensively, very long hours, and then taking a long weekend off with my girlfriends and going to Ibiza and doing a fitness retreat or something like that. Now that I've got a lovely man in my life who would like some more of my time, my priorities have changed. So very much 2 years ago, it was about sitting down with him and saying, right, what do we want in our life? And what we want is to live aboard his boat, travel around the world, sail around the world, and just be able to experience things. And rather than working with a little bit of sailing, which is what we do now, we would like to sail with a little bit of work. And so it was about looking at what fitted into that long-term strategy and working back from that. And I know this is all really simple stuff, but when you're a property developer and you think, how am I going to scale my business? Being a developer doesn't actually work because you can't be on site. And while you can have the best project managers in the world and the best construction team, nothing beats having your eyes and boots on the ground. And so for me, then that was the change in strategy to say, okay, we're now going to just invest in rental properties or commercial that are managed so that we can just have that time that we want, because time's the only thing that we can't make any more of.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And I would argue maybe that's phase two of most investors' journey, right? Like, because you can't go to where you are in phase two without probably having gone through phase one. So looking back on, you know, when you guys were in the massive kind of scaling side of your business, what are some things that you, if you were to do it over again, that you would repeat? And what are some things that you would say, hey, I would probably do this differently?
I think the first thing is the one thing that I did very, very well was work on my personal brand and really invest time in social media. And I was at the forefront of doing that here in the UK. There weren't many people investing time on Instagram, Facebook, all the other social platforms at that time. So we're talking a good 6 years ago. And so I really built up my following on that. And I would spend 1 to 2 hours a day, and still do actually, just interacting with people on those platforms. And that really helped me. And even now, people just know me. And that's great. It's great when things are going well, actually. When things are not, they're going, oh, Nicole. But when things are going well, if they've got sites that come up in the areas they know that I buy, I'm the first one they contact. If people want to work with me because they know that if I'll shout them out. And so I get discounts and I get things, and that's really great. And so I would really, really recommend that people not hide behind this corporate brand, that you actually work on your personal brand, because people want to get to know the person behind the brand. And we all have things that are truly unique about us that will make us stand out. And especially if you're a minority in an industry, in the beginning, I was a minority in my industry. So I stuck out because I was the blonde woman in a sea of men. But if you are one of those men, you don't stick out. So you've got to make yourself stick out, whether it be your, I don't know, stripy socks, or whether it be the ties you wear, bow ties, or your round glasses, whatever it might be, you've got to make yourself memorable. And so that's the one thing that I did that I think was right, and I'd recommend for other people to do. The thing that I would change is I would have much stricter structures in place for overseeing. I think that I probably trusted people who I employed too much with, I let go of things too much. I'm very good at just outsourcing and forgetting. Whereas I think that I probably would have held a little more closely to some of the management functions within the portfolio, because maybe a couple of years down the line, I realized that things just weren't done properly. And had I've overseen them, it would have been a much smoother process. So I think most management books say outsource and forget and allow people just to get on with things. But I would say bring them in a bit closer and just keep a closer eye on things, because your eyes are the best ones.
Right, right. Do you feel like that occurred just because you had too many irons in the fire?
Yeah, definitely. We scaled too fast. And I really do put my hand up and say that was the big issue. And it nearly derailed us. And we're a bit like Icarus, who flew a little too close to the sun. And it was scary. A couple of years ago, it was really, really scary. And I got very gray. But I always say to people, and I don't charge for it, any courses or anything like that, but I'm always happy to give my knowledge or what I have of it for free. But I always say to people, do you want to get advice from people who have never, a ship's captain who's never weathered a storm, or someone who's been through the storm and knows how to weather that storm? That's what I think has the most value.
Right, absolutely. And that's one of the questions I actually have when we invest passively with other investors is like, tell me about a deal that went wrong. How did you handle that? And if somebody answered, if they reply back to me, well, you know, we've always made money, I probably actually am not going to invest with them. I hate to say that, but it's just because I know that they haven't experienced really difficult times yet. If everything they've touched has turned to gold, then when things go wrong, they're not going to know what to do. So
yeah,
that's great. When it comes to crowdfunding, you guys were on the forefront of that. Like, how did you get in front of that? How did you guys manage the legal side of it? How did you even know? I mean, even today here in the States, where they've relaxed a lot of the laws around it. And again, I don't know how this applies in the UK, but how did you really educate and then launch a platform to raise money on the crowdfunding side? I mean, that's a pretty audacious undertaking.
Yeah, it was really, I guess, fortuitous, because I was on the speaking circuit, as it's called, because I loved it. I think you become a performer and you just love getting up and speaking. Sure. And especially when it's your story, because you just can't get it wrong. It's just, you don't have to prepare. It's just, here's my story.
Right.
So I love that. And I started speaking at all these various events, and people would come up to me all the time and say, please, can we get involved? Can we invest? And I didn't want their money, because for me, there are very strict rules around collective investment schemes. So you have to be very careful about how you take other people's money. And I just didn't want the hassle. And then this startup crowdfunding platform came to me and said, we're launching and we'd really like to partner with you. And that then gave me this compliant wrapper, this regulated wrapper in which people could then invest. So because I'd worked on my social media and because I had quite a following, I was then very easily able to say, right, I now have this compliant way in which you can invest. And it was very easy. There's with interest rates so low, interest rates are below 0.5% here now, but there's so many people with money to invest that even 5-6% return is brilliant to them. And when you're offering a double digit return, it's a very attractive offering to people. So that's how we got started in that. And we did that from 2016, 17 through to 18. Then recently the laws have changed. So towards the end of 2019, actually, the laws have tightened up and you're no longer allowed to market to retail investors. There's just really tightened rules, which I think is a good thing for the industry. I think there were too many people just setting up and abusing the system. So it's really tightened up now.
How was that once you took the money in-house? I mean, did it go towards a specific project? Was it into a fund that they invested? Or how did that, I'm sorry to ask the granular details on, I'm just curious, like how did that work?
It's really different depending on the project. Now, there are different platforms that are just debt, and they're called peer-to-peer, and there are ones that are equity. Right. And a lot of times the debt ones are very prescriptive about how you can set those up. But the equity ones, the equity platforms, it's just however you want to set this up, you come to us with a proposal, we'll compliance check it. If it passes our compliance, then you can put it out there. So it could be that you want to sell down your equity. It could be that you want to do an option, which again, that's a zero-sum game. You could lose everything with an option. So it's very much buyer beware. You could structure anything. There are some people doing invest to learn type arrangements where they'd invest in an option and they'd get an education program along with it. Some people kind of like the more of the Kickstarter type things. They'd get not just a return, but they'd get something. They'd get site tours or access to various information. So anything that you could think of that you thought that people might invest in, you could do.
Wow. Good for you for taking that bull by the horns right out of the gate. Yeah, it's cool that somebody came along that you could partner with. But even so, I think about that from my perspective. I'm like, gosh, that's a lot of risk, not just risk, but a lot of responsibility to take on when you're bringing on that many investors. And
it's too much. It really is too much. And I think that if you've got a full-time employee looking after investor relations, that's fine. But if you don't, it just becomes a headache. And it's, in my opinion, it's not worth it, because I did feel really strongly that I felt that I was giving people with as little as £500 the opportunity to invest in developments that were only available to professional investors. And I felt that it democratized the industry. But now I realize in hindsight that some of them didn't even understand the shareholders agreement, or they didn't understand the structure. They didn't understand that the way that some contributions were debt or equity. They didn't understand the way that debt ranks ahead of equity. It's only as we've gone through this process that I realized that there are huge understanding gaps within this so-called sophisticated investor network. And that is, it's a huge responsibility to take on, and probably not one that I would take on again.
Right. A huge responsibility and a liability, I would imagine. I mean, because then you're answering questions, and not just it's a time suck as well as just a liability of, my gosh, like you don't know what you're even involved in. And here I am trying to explain it to you. So that's really interesting. That's a really interesting cautionary tale that I have not yet heard before, but I'm glad to hear it from somebody who's been through it firsthand. So that's great. Let's jump into the final four, which the first question is, if you were to distill everything you know, so rewind back through your first investment all the way till now, and you were to distill everything you know down to one piece of advice for an aspiring investor, what would that one piece of advice be?
It's a marathon, not a sprint. We all try to just get rich tomorrow, and it's not that at all. This is a long term. It's taken me 10 years to get to the position where I'm financially secure. And you say that to a 25-year-old, it's going to take you 10 years, you're going to be 35, and they go, no way, that's, my kids call me a boomer. I'm going to be a, you, that's a boomer. So I think it's just be patient. This is, how many careers do people have now? So many. If it takes you 10 years to be financially secure, that's amazing.
Right, right. No, in 10 years compared to our, you know, parents and our parents' parents, that's,
yeah,
that's really fast. So yeah, good for you. What's one thing you're currently doing to stay on top of your game?
I'm trying to do less, which I know sounds strange, but I'm trying to just not cram as much into my days and just keep a bit more focused with what I do. And I've learned how to say no. So if something doesn't fit within my purpose and it doesn't fit within the core things that I do, then I say no. And I think that's really helped to set those boundaries, because otherwise every new opportunity that would come my way, I'd go, yes, that's exciting, I'm taking it up. And then something else would come and I'd go, yes, I'm going to do this now. And it just got a bit too confusing. So now it's just having those boundaries and saying no to things.
Right. Sounds like simplification is a big part of your journey. So
yeah,
that's fantastic. When it comes to giving back, what's one way you're making the world a better place?
Two ways. First of all, we do a lot. As I said, I'm always giving away my information or whatever I know, the little bits that I know for free. I'm happy just to give that away. That's the first thing. And then being a sailor, I'm really active with definitely plastics in the ocean. And so work with Big Blue Ocean Cleanup to just help make our oceans cleaner. Because while we're sailing around, we just see so much plastic in the ocean. So just about raising awareness for that as well. And that's something that we're going to be doing a lot more of in the new year. So I'm very excited about that.
That's awesome. Like I would not, that's just not something, obviously I'm land bound in the middle of the United States. And so not something I would think about. And what a wild thing to think there's that much trash in the ocean. So that's very cool that yeah, you are undertaking that. Nicole, what's the best way, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
I'm on every social media platform, even TikTok. But the best way is probably my website, which is nicolebremner.com.
Awesome. Nicole, thank you so much for your time. This was absolutely a pleasure having you on, and certainly have learned a lot. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.